Good morning again. The parties are here asking for you all to better define, I guess, terms, particularly the term abandonment when it comes to relation to the 2915 and 2916 requirements for counsel, and also to explain more how it is that a court, circuit court, should deal with an application that's made for abandonment of counsel and how that should be dealt with.
What ambiguity do you think there is in our opinions regarding what constitutes abandonment? How have we defined abandonment to this point?
Basically, Chief Justice, you look at your cases, particularly Cantrell and then also Price most recently. But basically what's been said is that the limits of that term have not been set. And particularly the Price case, four of you judges made clear that to the extent that there's going to be any expansion of that term, that it needs to be in keeping with what the rule is looking at in terms of the appointment of counsel and what the responsibilities are of appointed counsel in terms of representing. What the problem that developed here was that we brought forth in this case a request for a finding of that Mr. Barton had been abandoned because of mental illness of his attorney. And we set that forth in detail in a petition. And the state came back and basically argued that is not, even if everything we said was true, they admitted everything that we said is true, even if all of that is true, this is not abandonment as they viewed the...
Can you tell me the difference you understand under your understanding of abandonment between abandonment and ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes, ma'am. Judge Stith, it really comes down to the cases that I've cited to you from other states, because this is an issue that this court has not had the opportunity to address directly. And it comes down to the kinds of things that when you have mental illness that prevents an attorney from functioning.
But why is that not ineffectiveness, whereas here he did file something that had many, many points that were raised, but your allegation is because of his mental illness he was not able to raise the points he should have?
How do you know when a person is mentally ill that the person who's got that representation is getting what they're supposed to get? There's no way to know, and that's why the courts that have looked at this situation have made the distinction between mental illness and simple negligence. Because what that is that the person who is suffering from the mental illness is skipping beats, is not with it, is not there at particular times when they are supposed to be. And the whole thing of the rules that are set down by this court is assuming that you've got capable counsel, counsel that's got all of their faculties about them. Mistakes are one thing. Mistakes are things that this court has been unwilling to say.
What about the fact that there were two lawyers appointed in this case?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't say.
What about the fact that there were two lawyers appointed in this case?
Judge Fisher, not only were there two lawyers appointed in the first place, when Brotherton was actually removed later because he sought leave to withdraw, two more were put into the case. The problem's twofold. Number one, the first lawyer was not qualified under 2916 to basically assess the record and create the petition. This court gives 90 days for the petition, essentially 90 days, 30 and then 60, to amend the petition. And
again, can I interrupt you for a second? Because how is that not ineffective assistance of counsel?
Chief Justice, I guess to call it ineffective assistance of counsel, there's a mistake made. And so you can call that ineffective assistance of counsel if you want to, but it's also ineffective assistance of counsel in the abandonment cases that this court has already talked about for a lawyer to not file a motion.
But there was a motion filed.
Yes, ma'am.
And can you cite any case from this court where a motion was filed that was not determined on its face to be insufficient, that there has been abandonment determined?
Cantrell.
And tell us how Cantrell supports you.
The situation in Cantrell was that what happened was that there was supposed to have been a notice of appeal filed after a completed 2915 proceeding. What happened was that the notice of appeal wasn't filed. The circuit court allowed for the order to be set aside of the judgment, and then when the order was re-entered, then an appeal was able to go forward.
And I ask you of this court.
That's a federal habeas case, right?
Yeah. Cantrell, I ask you any decision of this court.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say Cantrell? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to talk about Cantrell, what I was talking about. And referring to was Crenshaw. I'm sorry. And what I was, and I apologize, the Crenshaw case is the one where this court allowed to stand a decision by the circuit court to set aside a judgment to allow for what ended up being a late filing of the notice of appeal.
So other than an untimely filing or the lack of a filing, this case looks more into the quality of the filing.
Yes, Judge Russell, it absolutely does.
Isn't that a huge distinction?
It is a definite distinction, and I understand the distinction that we're talking about, and that's the reason why I looked for the cases that I've found for the court in saying why that is a distinction here that makes a big difference.
And if I understand you, you're saying this court should hold as a matter of policy that if counsel is statutorily disqualified from representing someone in a death case like this, or if they're mentally ill and therefore not capable of offering effective representation, we should hold as a policy matter that's equivalent to abandonment because there's no qualified counsel available to represent them.
It is definitionally abandonment, Judge Steve, I think under you all have certainly never so found. And I understand that the limitations on the cases as they have come down to this point. But this court has always held open that there would be other circumstances, and particularly Price contemplates it, and not Cantrell, but Crenshaw contemplates it, that the limits are not there.
If you had made this case during his PCR, in the context of a motion to amend the amended motion or otherwise, we would have a judgment in front of us and an action by the trial court that either allowed or didn't allow the relief he sought. Here, their judgment in the PCR is over and done with and final. What's the matter before us? What judgment are you appealing? And if it's not a judgment, what's your authority for appealing?
Judge, it's basically the authority that this court has given for abandonment of counsel. It's a situation.
Appeals are statutory, and so what's sure. If there isn't a judgment you're appealing, what is it you're appealing, and what statute allows you to do it?
Well, the judgment was the judgment of the circuit court to not allow a hearing and made the finding.
It's a judgment in what? you know, a judgment usually disposes of all the claims and all the parties in a matter. This sounded like some sort of post-judgment motion for relief, either from the judgment. See, I'm having a hard time just identifying the procedural posture.
Well, and that is this court's allowance of petitions regarding abandonment.
Well, but
it's by court
ruling. It's dealing with whether or not an amendment.
I'm sorry, sir.
Oh, sorry. So I guess since he already had his post-conviction relief, right, which was affirmed on appeal.
Yes, sir.
So did you? What do you think that you filed entitles you to file a successive post-conviction motion?
I don't think I'm entitled to file a successive post-conviction motion at all.
And there's no real thing to open up. This is not really a motion to reopen, which we said is not a valid petition.
But clearly, when there has been abandonment, the court court goes back into the PCR case. And that's why you want it to be designated as abandonment.
Yes,
so that
there is a pending case. I tried to follow your lead on that precisely in terms of what the proper terminology would be, and hopefully did.
So starting with that this court has recognized when there is abandonment, even though there has been a final disposition of PCR, that case is reopened as if there is abandonment.
Exactly, and I think you said it shouldn't be called reopened,
right.
But, you know,
exactly.
However, it's done, and that comes back to Judge Wilson's question. I mean, it's the authority that this court has allowed that I'm invoking.
Okay, but at least that I can recall, those cases arose when the original motion was untimely and abandonment was claimed, and those are the extraordinary ones. Or when the amended motion was ruled untimely and the appeal raises the question of abandonment. That was the last three cases. But when has anybody raised abandonment after an amended motion was tried to judgment and affirmed on appeal?
I'm the first.
All right. And how procedurally could we get at that?
Just exactly the way that you would get at it when a person has not filed a motion in the first place.
Right. Then they file. The judge says this was untimely dismissed, and you appeal. That's Lovelton Sanders.
I can't think of our recent case, but where that was the one where we said you shouldn't properly style it as reopening the case, but we did permit it to be filed.
Correct.
It is comparable to this, where after the fact, because it was abandonment, if this is abandonment, we said you can go back in after the fact, because since you didn't have counsel, of course you wouldn't have had someone to raise this necessarily on appeal because you had no competent counsel. But it comes back to, is this like that case? Is this abandonment? Because it is a very different basis of claiming abandonment than
there's no question but that there's a difference here, Judge Steve. But it's a difference that's significant. And again, what I go back to is Crenshaw and Price, where this court has clearly indicated that the limits of abandonment have not been fixed. So,
it would absolutely require the ignoring of the rule that this is a successive motion. I mean, abandonment has allowed the late filing of an amended motion under some very limited circumstances, but it's never been permitted to file a successive motion.
Actually, it would be a replacement motion, Judge Fisher.
Well, what's the difference between a replacement one and a successive one?
It would include all of the issues to whatever extent there were any that were worthwhile originally filed, and issues that were clearly left out could have been put in the first time around.
Please go ahead.
Essentially, what you've got is you're starting from square one, and as if the idea is it's as if there was not a petition filed in the first place.
And that's what we held in whatever the most recent case written by Judge Brackenridge was.
Yes,
that you treated
like that's
that.
Exactly right.
What if we do not find this case as an abandonment case? So, if in fact we've held we don't it's a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel is not cognizable. The question is your interpretation of abandonment being left open. If abandonment, the jurisprudence on abandonment does not allow this to be abandonment claim or an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, do you have any legal basis, any procedural legal basis to raise this claim?
In the state of Missouri? Chief Justice, there are ways of raising procedurally defaulted claims in federal court to some degree.
Speaking to Martinez?
Yes. Yes. And those ways, though, have fallacies, defects, problems that bring those issues and the way, because of the way that they're being raised, it really undercuts the vitality of those issues if you're having to go at it in that way. Besides that, it doesn't allow this court, the Missouri courts, to look at issues that you ought to have a chance to look at. And that comes back to the whole point here, which has to do with the abandonment of counsel here is the mental illness of counsel not presenting issues that you should have expected because of the dictates of the rule that you would be able to decide and not have some federal court coming in and looking at that. And frankly, that's the whole way that everything is set up to try to have the Missouri Supreme Court and the Missouri courts decide this.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Spillane. I represent the state of Missouri. You've had some hard cases this morning. This isn't one of them. The standard of review is clear error. For 25 years, this court, since 1991, has said abandonment means total inaction by counsel or action that is so bad that is essentially a nullity. That doesn't exist here. The PCR court, assuming that the case is even properly in front of this court, the PCR court did not make clear error by following this court's precedents and not expanding them to include something that has never existed before and would be contrary to this court's precedents. So there's no clear error, and I think that's the end of the case. I want to mention Crenshaw. The other side is overselling Crenshaw a little bit. Crenshaw was a notice of appeal case, and what this court did say was it has to be a nullity, and we're not sure exactly what the limits of a nullity are, but generally it is not filing a motion or not filing a timely motion. And that was a case where a notice of appeal was not timely filed from the PCR. And this court did not say that was abandonment. What this court said in Crenshaw was, we won't reach the issue. We see they've got nothing that has any merit anyway, so we don't have to go there. But this court did go there in Gerke later and said filing a notice of appeal or failing to file a notice of appeal from a PCR is not abandonment because it doesn't fit within this court's precedents. So I don't think there's anything in Crenshaw that helps them. They cite a lot of federal cases about equitable tolling. And what those cases are about a case in which an attorney didn't file something, didn't file a petition, didn't file a complaint, didn't file a response to discovery, didn't file a response to summary judgment and lost on a default judgment. But if the petitioner in this case had not filed an amended petition, which he did file, then we wouldn't be here. So those cases aren't relevant. Those are cases where an attorney that they cite from the federal courts, where an attorney actually did nothing when he was supposed to file something. So those don't really help him. There are good reasons not to expand abandonment. I think this court talked about them in Price, talked about a little bit about them in Gerke, and it's a very narrow remedy for a very narrow purpose, which is to enforce Rule 2915. This case has nothing to do with enforcing Rule 2915. You handled the appeal of the PCR that is being challenged here. It was over 300 pages long, raised nearly 50 claims. There's nothing incoherent about it. It is not a pleading that it is a nullity. It's a very good pleading. And I think the court may agree with me on that. It's, I don't believe that there's merit to it, but many pleadings that there is not legal merit to in the sense that you went on the merits are the best you can do with what you have. What they've done here and what they did at the lower court was say, ah, we have 8 claims that we think are better. That's ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel by allegation. And they're listed, the claims are listed in their legal file, and I don't think you have to reach this level of analysis, but they're not really better. They're claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for not raising plain error. One of those is that the appellate counsel should have alleged that the trial court should have sua sponte inserted itself into the case in a way that might have violated the double jeopardy clause. There are claims about ineffective assistance of trial counsel for the way the cross-examination and impeachment was done. That's a pure matter of trial strategy. And we don't need to go into this too much, but I think they're pushing the edge to try and say, ah, we have these 8 claims that are better. And even if they were better, it's not a claim of abandonment, but I think they're reaching to say that they're better. When you're talking about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for not raising plain error claims of the type that they're alleging, or for not doing cross-examination.
That's not the basis so much the trial court denied it, though, is it? The trial court didn't reach the merits.
I'm saying the only reason, you're absolutely right, you don't have to go that far. The only reason that is relevant is that the motion that was filed is not a nullity. I think we could think of a motion that was a nullity. I think a very old example is if there was a facially insufficient original motion and someone simply copied it and it was facially insufficient. That might be a nullity, but this isn't. The old cases when verification and signature were required. Now they're not anymore, as you know, because that's not a jurisdictional requirement. To have signature and verification isn't required, but suppose 20 years ago someone had turned one of those in. That might be a nullity, but this isn't it. And that's why I went to speak about the motion, just to show you that it's not. It's a good motion. I mean, one could always think of examples, and I think that is why this court left open that the precise limits of abandonment aren't determined, because one can always think of an example where an amended motion might be a nullity. I mean, someone could draw 300 pages of unicorns and rainbows, and no one would argue that that was a nullity. But that isn't what we have here. And what they're asking this court to do is to condemn the trial court for committing clear error for following 25 years of precedent. And there's no error here. And also, they talked a little bit about Martinez. One of the briefs cites to their motion asking that their federal habeas corpus case, which is pending, be held in abeyance, which they've successfully done, arguing that this is a necessary thing, this abandonment litigation, to exhaust their state remedies. Well, no, it's not, and we don't want it to be. This court doesn't want it to be. Every inmate that loses a PCR in Missouri shouldn't be able to say, the ordinary course of review involves filing a motion alleging abandonment, therefore I don't have to start my federal litigation yet. And in a death penalty case, you could delay it for years. This case has been going on for it's more than 20 years. The decision this court made last time noted the claim that it was an Eighth Amendment violation to carry out the execution because it's been going on for 20 years. But as long as they've now moved to stay their federal litigation successfully, alleging that this is part of the ordinary course of review, which can have no effect other than to delay further review so that they can make a stronger claim that it's taken so long it's an Eighth Amendment violation. So there's a certain amount of gamesmanship going on here. I don't see I've used very much time. Does the court have any questions?
Any questions?
Well, and I'll talk a little bit about federal habeas, not entirely relevant, but the thing they cited in their brief, that is cited in the brief for stay, also alleges that they're going to file in Rule 91 in this court if they lose in this proceeding, and that the stay should continue for that. So I assume that's also going to be coming at you. And I assume they will make some sort of a Martinez v. Ryan argument. And I would argue to the court that at this time, when you see it, I or whoever does it will argue to you that Martinez v. Ryan should not be extended to the state courts. But even if one did that, many of their claims are ineffective assistance of direct appeal counsel. And a case in the Eighth Circuit called Dansby v. Hobbs teaches that Martinez v. Ryan doesn't cover that. It only covers ineffective assistance of PCR counsel for not raising an ineffective assistance of trial counsel. So what they're trying to do here is to get more than they could get under Martinez anyway. I guess that's about all I have to say, and I'll sit down if there are no questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with last things first. I don't know where counsel's coming up with his notion about what arguments he thinks I'm going to raise. I've never indicated any such thing. I've brought you the issue, which is the correct issue for the circumstances we are facing. And this is not a opening the floodgates kind of situation. Folks, I would think that you would want to address and want to have addressed situations where there is a legitimate worry that a counsel was mentally ill at the time he was discharging his duties under Rule 2915 and 2916 in the capital case.
What did you know when this request was made in the trial court that you couldn't have known during the motion court litigation on the PCR or the appeal on the PCR?
What did I know, or what did
the movement know?
The trouble for the movement is that in terms of preparing the petition, the only person who was involved in that was Gary Brotherton, nobody else.
Well, the facts that were alleged below in the request to have an abandonment hearing, was there anything new that was alleged there that wasn't known or couldn't have been known during the original PCR litigation or the appeal from that?
In terms of couldn't have been known, a hard question to answer, because frankly, the lawyers who were put into the case to replace Brotherton were not given any more time except to prepare for hearing on the petition that Brotherton had prepared. There was not time for somebody to go back and do what Brotherton should have done in the first place, which is examine the record and prepare a petition. That's where the issues are in this case. That's where the problem is the soul of amending the petition, the whole right to that, because of the lack of Brotherton's ability, nobody then followed up on that, frankly, until Mike Walker and I took over the case and did that work and found the issues. And I'd be delighted to have the hearing that I think this court has required of circuit courts to order, and have the very debate that counsel wants to have over the significance of the issues that we've raised. Had that been done, then you would have in front of you the record that you would need to know what the value is of everything I've been saying to you. Unfortunately, we don't have that kind of record, and that's because the circuit court erred by not having the hearing that this court clearly anticipates in its rulings previously, that kind of record needs to be made in detail, and that's what hasn't been done here.
In your view, Mr. Picard, did you have to file an abandonment claim to exhaust your state remedies for your federal habeas?
I don't know about that in terms of the federal issues, Judge Fisher. What it seemed to me is that I start with you all, and frankly, you won't be seeing me back, counsel's worries notwithstanding, about anything further in this regard, simply because you've got my best shot. You know, there's no more in terms of this issue. And in terms of addressing this issue, frankly, I could have tried through the Martinez versus Ryan approach to address this issue directly with the federal district court. The trouble is that that's a limited ability, and it also doesn't go to the folks who really should be deciding this issue, and that's you all. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.